This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. This week on the Compass, we talk with a Mennonite minister and her husband about the dangers to humanity they believe to be posed by the development of artificial intelligence and the rapidly accelerating technological revolution that presents the very real possibility of replacing people in pretty much every field, from childcare to making life and death decisions in the battlefield. So now, let's go inside the Compass. In the brochure for their newly founded Tree of Life Education and Retreat Center, Mennonite minister Megan Lumsdaine and her husband Peter Lumsdaine declare the need for a movement which must become as powerful as the global upsurge around fossil fuels and climate chaos to counter the perils to humanity they see arising out of a technological system that is, quote, aggressively pushing its global power and control by automation of society and war. A system, they say, is corroding the basic integrity of life. I visited the Lumsdaines recently in the little farmhouse they share with their two young children, and which also serves as headquarters for the Tree of Life Center. We talked around their kitchen table over cups of tea. Why don't we start off by you talking a little bit about your backgrounds and how you arrived where you are today and what the Tree of Life Center is.
Well, I have been an ordained pastor since 1998. I am in the Mennonite faith, and I've had many years of very joyful ministry as a pastoral leader. And this transition, I would say, is not one that I went looking for, but rather came to me, because I see that now there is a new era that we have entered into. And with that, we have to respond in new ways. And I think one of the key questions of the 21st century is, how do we invite ourselves back to receiving our humanity? And that sounds in some ways like a crazy question, but increasingly I see that there is so much in our society and in our world that is dehumanizing and drawing us away from our humanity. And now I feel that in several realms, including the spiritual, we need to cultivate what it really means to be human. And so that's why at Tree of Life we are working to protect our humanity, our community, and the natural creation. And we feel that that is a real calling, not only that we have, but we want to invite other people into as well.
This is obviously a really big question, but what do you mean by humanity, and how are we losing it?
It is a big question when we say that, and it sounds almost absurd to have to even define what it means to be human. But for instance, just this past October, there was an announcement of the robot Sophia. Ironically, horribly, that name means wisdom, and it is my daughter's name, and so you can imagine how this makes me cringe. And she made her big debut in Saudi Arabia and in front of wealthy business owners at a conference there, and she explained that her goal and mission is for the betterment of society. And the lines increasingly are being blurred as we understand that she is the first robot, and I use the term she in quotations here, the first robot to have citizenship, to be given citizenship, not only in Saudi Arabia, but the entire world. This in stark contrast to the many foreign workers who are in Saudi Arabia who are denied citizenship. And so we see that if a robot is actually being granted citizenship, what does that mean for how we define what it means to be human? And that's just one example.
So she's been given the vote.
There's the vote.
It really is a very key question about human rights. It really brings that right to the front and center. Right now, there are plans underway announced to build a megacity, $500 billion megacity, that is for the wealthy. And it is going to be populated by robot servants. And when you think about the fact that in Saudi Arabia, its capital city, only 20% of the people have decent sanitation. It's deplorable when we look at this.
I think it's not a coincidence that
one of the most dictatorial and brutal regimes on the planet, which is now, according to the United Nations, bringing about or enforcing the worst famine in 50 years in Yemen with the war that they're waging there, is also at the very forefront of introducing these machines as servants, as spokespeople or spokes devices, as somehow equivalent to, or in fact, as Meg was saying, superior to human beings. And it calls to mind very much something that Martin Luther King said in 1967, 1 year before he was assassinated, in his Riverside Church speech, which is where he came out in opposition to the Vietnam War. And he said towards the end of that speech, he said, this is a direct quote, "When machines and computers, profits and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of racism, materialism, and militarism are incapable of being conquered. The choice is ours, and though we might prefer it otherwise, we must choose at this crucial moment of human history." So King's words, I think, are so applicable today in light of what is unfolding now, what Meg was talking about.
In recent weeks, there's been lots of stories. Like just yesterday in the New York Times, there was a big feature that started off with multiple images of a young woman who looked very glamorous and sort of familiar. And on the inside, there was a bunch of different photographs of various people, all of whom, you know, you look at them and you say, well, those are kind of familiar faces. And there was a quiz question, which is, which of these people are real? Well, it was a trick question because none of them were real. These were all generated by algorithms. Right. And, you know, we're entering a world where discerning fact from fiction is becoming increasingly difficult. And the edges between what is man-made and what is human are becoming really blurred. And I don't know if you'd like to comment on that.
Absolutely. That distinction is increasingly becoming blurred. I find it very interesting that in 2016, Sony was announcing its production and research into developing a robot that is going to have emotions. And whether or not that robot feels emotions, that's not the point. The point is just that it is made to bond emotionally with the customer base so that they have the illusion that this robot is actually their friend. Now, what is the purpose of this? Of course, the purpose of this is to sell the product and manipulate the customer into buying the product that they are offering. So when we can no longer distinguish between an emotional bond between a human or a robot entity, where does this lead us ultimately? I think it's very hopeful that there was a campaign against the toy or monitoring device Aristotle that was brought by the company Mattel. And the people came together to make a petition to have the company not to distribute this AI device that would be to monitor babies or all the way through adolescence and to give information to the company on how this child is developing and so that they can market to them. But it's marketed as an assistant to the parents, but really it's a very sophisticated tool in manipulation. But people decided, no, we don't feel this is right. We don't want our children being reared by an artificial intelligence device, and we want this product not to be available. So they had a campaign, and they were successful. And Mattel ended up withdrawing that product. So I think that we do have a voice that we can exercise. We do have power that we can give so that we can say, no, we don't want to be socialized by robots. We don't want to be manipulated by robots. We do not want the artificial intelligence devices to be the dominant socializing mechanism that we have in society, so we can reclaim our power.
You know, it's interesting. There's a professor at MIT, Sherry Turkle, and for some years she has been the director of their technology and society program there at MIT, and she started out as an early advocate in some sense of the internet and the horizons that it's opened and so forth and so on. But over the years, she has become increasingly concerned, in fact, alarmed at where these accelerating electronic technologies are leading us as humanity and society. And so her most recent book, which is called Alone Together, Why We Expect More and More from Technology and Less from Each Other, really articulates this concern that she's had. She talks about the rise of social robotics, robots as caregivers, robots as teachers, robots as therapists. We have this little quote from Professor Turkle on the front of our Tree of Life Education and Retreat Center brochure. And she said, there is no upside to being socialized by a robot. So she's very concerned that human-human interactions are increasingly being replaced by and mediated through human-machine interactions. But really, you know, what Tree of Life and our work is about is recognizing and affirming and uplifting and protecting the positive, protecting the water, the land, the forests, the agriculture, the ecosystems, and human communities on this planet, which are all at enormous and increasing risk from the acceleration of electronic technologies, from the minerals that are ripped from the ground, and not just fossil fuels, to build more and more and more machines. We've seen this at Oak Flat, Arizona, near the San Carlos Apache Reservation. We've seen this in Zacualpan, Mexico, and the Western Sierra Madre, where minerals are being targeted by multinational corporations and governments to be extracted from indigenous lands to build more and more devices, more and more computers, more and more drones, robots, technological machines. And so, you know, from that end of the cycle to the very other end, where people, kids especially, but people of all ages, are increasingly being socialized and hooked into a worldwide electronic matrix, which more and more controls their thoughts, attitudes, ideas, interactions, and so forth. This is a profound concern. So what we're really about is this idea that came out of Standing Rock, right, North Dakota. We went out there a couple of times. I went out in September of last year, and then Meg and I and our two children, who are now 10 and 13 years old, went out there in December when the vets mobilization happened. And they had this idea at Standing Rock: we're not protesters, we're protectors. We're not protesters, we're protectors. We're protecting the water, we're protecting the children's future. So that's what we're really about, is trying to lay the groundwork and reaching out into the Jefferson County community and beyond to build a team to protect that which we value most from the forces that are increasingly corroding it. And I'll just add too that, you know, some of the most eloquent and powerful voices that are ringing the alarm bells and raising the red flags about this come from right in the center of the high-tech industry, right? People who are scientific luminaries, like Dr. Stephen Hawking from England and Dr. Sherry Turkle at MIT, and high-tech industrialists like Elon Musk, who has said that, you know, we are playing with fire in our accelerating development of artificial intelligence. He went so far as to say, our society with artificial intelligence is summoning the demon. Just like these old stories of the magicians who conjured up the spirits that they were confident would serve them. But it doesn't work out that way in the end. So, you know, we're trying to identify a major emerging threat, which is interlocked with the climate threat, by the way, with the extraction of resources and energy to run these machines and so forth. A major emerging threat which we need to protect our jobs, our farms, our families, our society from.
You said something there that I'm sure there are those would take exception to, which is that, you know, like this matrix is actually controlling the direction of culture. Many would say that actually the internet has really opened up human exchange and the possibility of, you know, it used to be that in order to publish, you had to own the printing press. Now everybody actually has their own soapbox, and there's an exchange of ideas out there on the internet, and we have seen whole social movements arise and being able to organize. The internet can kind of cut both ways, right?
I think our point is not to say we need to abolish the internet and, you know, do an altar call, bring up your iPhones and throw it in the trash, you know, sisters and brothers. That's not the point. But let me make this analogy. You know, many of us will visit relatives, we'll go to cultural events, we'll go to organizing meetings about social and environmental concerns that we care about. We'll go to pick up our box of vegetables from the local CSA in what? Our car, right? And what do we fill up our car with? We fill it up with Exxon and Mobil and Chevron and Shell fossil fuel. Let's be real about this. So therefore, what is the problem with fossil fuels? Why are people complaining about this in Port Townsend and Jefferson County and Washington State? No. You know, there's a structural problem here. And I think we are starting to recognize that we, as generally speaking, as individuals and as communities and as society, are addicts. We're addicts to fossil fuel and the fossil fuel industry. That does not mean it's all our fault, because you know what? There's a pusher. There's a pusher called Exxon and Mobil and the governments of the planet. But 100 years ago, cars were coming onto the market, right? The Model T and all this stuff, and you know, and the oil industry was booming. And everybody back then, from the far right industrialists and military leaders to the far left, you know, labor unions and anarchists, everybody thought the cars were good. It was just a question of how they were distributed, cars for the people, so forth. But if we look back now 100 years later, across a century of oil use, and oil spills, and oil wars, and an increasing pollution and disruption of our atmosphere, we might say, like, well, maybe that wasn't such a good idea to build a society, a national and global society built on fossil fuels. So we're trying to raise that same question and concern. There would be no climate movement. There would be no fossil fuel movement if people were not first aware that there was a problem, which leads to the next step, which is, what do we do about it?
There was an article just last week in the New York Times about how law, medicine, you know, like many of the careers that in the past have been the high-paying, you know, like sort of aspirational careers that that kids would work for, you know, look like they're rapidly being replaced by, and it's something hard for me to sort of think about. I mean, if an algorithm can take your symptoms and more frequently come up with an accurate diagnosis, should we avoid that technology in the interest of, like, you know, maintaining good high paid jobs for doctors? Another great example was, well, suppose autonomous vehicles really get to the point, as they appear to be already getting to the point, where they're safer and, like, you know, better drivers in general than humans. I understand that truck driving is right up there among, like, the largest number of people are employed as independent truck drivers. It's one of the last sort of run your own business kind of things that are left.
Well, I think, Steve, this really is very similar to the previous question that you asked, that what about the benefits that this will bring to society, artificial intelligence? And, of course, people will readily put those out, especially those who are developing these innovations will tell you what kinds of benefits it's going to bring in medicine, how we're going to be able to do better research, how we're going to eradicate disease, how we're going to assist all of these occupations, chiefly in the medical field, but all kinds of different industries. And they're talking about not eliminating jobs so much, but grafting jobs. We are enhancing jobs. So, for instance, let's take the example of the home health care field. What is happening already in Japan is that these jobs that could be done by humans for caring for the elderly are now being done by robots. The industries that create these robots say, this is wonderful because we are able to answer the problem of the labor shortage that we have for people who are nursing assistants and such. I find it very interesting. John Markoff has a book called Machines of Loving Grace, and he is not in any way a Luddite, but he is, in his book, making an argument that, in fact, there really is no such thing as a labor shortage. What there is, however, is a shortage of decent living wages to pay people to go into these homes to care for the elderly. And so indeed, there are many people who would like to be in these fields, but in the effort to create the most efficient structure, the most productive in terms of earning wages for these corporations that develop these products, they are pushing out humans who could do this type of work. Just the issue of unemployment alone should be raising alarms for all of us of how these machines are going to start, first of all, with low-wage jobs such as telemarketers and such that the machines can do quite easily. Then you mentioned about the truck drivers. They're already developing trucks and cars that can drive themselves. And so where do these people find jobs? And the jobs that involve creative thought or human interaction, these might be the last, but they will be replaced as well. So have we really talked about and really discerned what we're going to do when there happens to be massive unemployment because of a robotic takeover of the economy?
You know, it's interesting you should mention truck drivers because they are right at the cutting edge of this. And I think that also emphasizes to me in terms of different sectors of society, you know, we do not believe that this is a right-left issue. This is not something to set, you know, liberals and conservatives against each other. This is something which, like, for instance, concerns about global trade and NAFTA and the World Trade Organization, corporate globalization. This is a common ground issue where people from different backgrounds and different points of view can indeed find common ground. And one of the examples that I would point out to folks who depend on truck driving for their living and many other folks in this society, I believe that Appalachia is one of the canaries in the coal mine for our society, not just in terms of, you know, the impoverishment of the rural working class there in the small towns, but also that there has been a shift from labor-intensive, employment-intensive underground mining, which over years and decades of struggle, the miners had brought into some kind of partial balance with their legitimate rights as employees through the United Mine Workers Union, okay? And I knew an older fellow who was in the timber industry, and he was really against unions, but he made an exception for the mine workers union. Says the conditions are so terrible there, I've got to say the union. Well, you know what has happened over the last few decades? I saw a film a couple of years ago by a woman named Mary Lynn Evans, who grew up in a mining family in Appalachia, and she made a film called Blood on the Mountain about the history of the struggles there. And one of the things that has happened and that is shown in this film is that the employment and the rights and the wages and the livelihood of so many families in Appalachia has been undermined by the automation of coal mining, the replacement of miners with these highly automated computerized machines that have one driver, you know, ripping off the sides and tops of mountains. And that automation from labor-intensive underground mining to automated surface mining, strip mining, mountaintop removal, among its other effects, including environmental devastation, has smashed the United Mine Workers Union. Okay, so if people are thinking that the introduction of more and more automated machines to replace human labor is going to somehow have a beneficial effect on society, they should look at Appalachia. So that's, for instance, even what Elon Musk, who's a, you know, billionaire industrialist, is saying, is that artificial intelligence represents an unprecedented threat of unemployment, of loss of human control of society, of global war to our planet. But that is only the case if we do not now put in place proactive limits, boundaries, and regulations, which Musk and many other people are pushing very hard to say, we've got to. I mean, I'm a businessman. I don't like regulation. We've got to regulate this thing before it reaches a certain point, because when it does reach that point, it's going to be too late.
You mentioned global war, and I think that might be a really good note to end on, because one of the most disturbing developments to me and to many has been the development of autonomous weapons or remotely controlled weapons such as, the Predator drones and so on, taking the risk to living, breathing human beings away from the battlefield, at least on the owner of the autonomous weapons side.
The issue of autonomous weapons, when we talk about giving a robot the decision between life and death of a human being, we should consider that extremely carefully before we give that type of power. And when we think about a robot on the battlefield, it may be able to distinguish many characteristics in a face, but can it really make a discernment between who is an enemy combatant and who is a civilian? And more than this, it makes war easier to engage with because we say, well, we save soldiers' lives. Well, then perhaps maybe we're more ready to go and unleash war all around the world because we feel that our casualties are going to be lessened. But maybe the civilian casualties will not be lessened because these autonomous machines go out and just indiscriminately make decisions. So there are many, many concerns. I know that Human Rights Watch is launching a campaign to stop killer robots, and they are urging people desperately to take this concern very seriously, to get involved. They are trying to advocate at the UN, but as the process there in the United Nations is rather slow, and this development of artificial intelligence is extremely fast and rapid, so that we need to gather together quickly and make our voice known, not only to our congressmen, but also to put pressure on these corporations that are developing these technologies and say that we do not want to give our power of discernment of life and death to a machine.
You know, there was an article which was published in the London Independent just about 3 years ago by Professor Stephen Hawking and several colleagues. There were four co-authors. And some of those people, in fact, all of them actually, in one way or another, are involved in something called the Future of Life Institute, which came out of MIT. They just produced a 7-minute video, which actually is accessible. People can dial it up and in a search, called Slaughterbots. And the 7-minute video was produced for the United Nations disarmament meetings in Geneva, Switzerland this autumn. And it is a kind of docudrama showing where this miniaturized autonomous weapons technology is likely to be leading in the next very, very few years from now, if not already. The question of artificial intelligence and advanced robotics is who will control it. But in the medium run, a little bit longer run, the even deeper question is, can it be controlled at all? We see our work here at the Tree of Life Education and Retreat Center, which we are just starting here in Port Hedlock, Washington. We are very much about that which is positive, that which is life-giving, that which we have a long track record as a human community of sustaining in our relationships with our children, our relatives, our neighbors, our land, our agriculture, our forests, our wildlife. That's what it's really about, is to honor and protect that for future generations in the light of a rising and still fairly invisible threat from this accelerating electronic technology industry.
Peter and Megan Lumsdaine will give a talk titled Artificial Intelligence Replacing Humanity and Nature at the Port Townsend Friends Meeting House, which is located at the corner of Sheridan Street and Discovery Road, on Thursday, January 18th, starting at 7 p.m. This is Steve Evans reporting for KPTZ Community Radio News. This week's KPTZ Compass was written and produced by Steve Evans. The Compass airs Mondays at noon and 5 p.m. and repeats the following Saturday at noon. You can listen to podcasts of past Compass programs at the kptz.org website, where you can also stream KPTZ Live 24 hours a day. For the news team here at KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, I'm Steve Evans.